Welcome to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant. The Legacy and Faith Show is about the journey of discovering how to create plans that protect wealth and family values for generations. And now the host of the Legacy and Faith Show, Paul Grant.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, it's another edition of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant. Hi there, Paul.
Hi, Mark.
Good to see you once again.
Thank you.
Hey, we are getting into a subject that I think is of interest to a lot of people if they follow their 401k or IRA or Roth or whatever the format is.
Right.
So you want to talk about how these investments fit in with your estate planning plan, and you've got a lot of thoughts on this.
Yeah, IRAs. I'm going to generalize and use the term IRAs for most of the discussion, but mm-hmm. you're right. That means a multiple a different type of account types. In other words, anything that is tax deferred. And the general public has been told save, and put money away into your IRA or 403b or 401k. In other words, take pre-tax money, which is a huge benefit. Take pre-tax money, throw it into this amazing account, and allow the whole amount to begin to work on your behalf. Mm. And what I have seen in estate planning is that these type of accounts have now become, for many individuals, one of the largest accounts that they hold, or one of the largest portions of wealth in their overall portfolio.
Sure.
The other one might be your house. So specifically, if you've lived there for a long period of time, you may have been in a position to pay it off, or you're getting close to paying it off. And so the value in your home would typically be the second largest asset that I see mm-hmm. in someone's estate.
Mm-hmm.
Only if you own a business. Businesses tend to be the largest for many individuals, but these retirement accounts, they tend to be one of the largest accounts that someone owns. And so we need to talk about how they work within an estate plan, because they are very restricted accounts.
Yeah.
And so we can't have the same type of flexibility in maneuvering a tax-deferred account as we would with other assets. And so to actually get at this type of an account, you're going to have to pay taxes on that money, so it becomes a more limited source or a more reserved source of
income. Unless you have a Roth.
Well, unless you've done some backdoor Roth conversions, then yes, Roths are a tax-free, but that means you've already paid the tax. So now we're going to take after-tax money and we're going to put it into an account that grows tax-free and the proceeds thereof, which is a great gig. But for the most part, Roth IRAs are a smaller portion of people's portfolio.
Hmm.
So it is typically—
Why do you think that is? Because people want the tax break.
That's right. Because, again, we've been told over and over and over, take pre-tax money, throw it into this account. Employers sometimes match a certain percentage of that. So because now, since the mid-90s, when these became a more predominant source as pension plans and went away, as unions started to crumble a little bit and people took more responsibility for their own retirement instead of relying upon the company, mm-hmm. now these accounts have had 30 years of growth. Now this first generation of really 401k, IRA mentality workers are now retiring, and the accounts are rather large.
Mm.
So in order to do good estate planning, the plan has to accommodate and think about this very large asset and this highly restricted asset. It's not restricted. It just means that you're going to have to pay a good amount of tax to utilize it. So when we start looking at an asset that is not as easily or maybe not as easily is the wrong word. Maybe it's the mentality of I shouldn't touch this except for the required minimum distributions, except for when I need to use it because it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt to for me to cash in more of this retirement account and pay the taxes. So with all that as kind of the backdrop, this is the larger a larger portion of people's portfolio as they walk into the office. And so wanted to take a couple shows and really start looking at this in depth with what does it mean to have a larger IRA. Again, that's the general term I'm going to use. And now how do we work that into an estate plan so that we can ensure that we have it available, plus it's going to be best for our beneficiaries. What does that all look like?
And the purpose of your discussion today is to talk about how these work with estate planning. You are not a financial advisor.
That's
so you're not going to tell people what to invest
no,
in.
No, absolutely not. Right. I'm not going to calculate RMDs. I'm not going to make suggestions of how and when to cash out IRAs. That is for a financial advisor to look at. Yes, there are some strategies in estate planning that also influence the cashing out of IRAs. But that's correct. I am not a financial advisor. I don't hold any of those licenses. I'm an attorney and I focus on estate planning. But this is, like I said, a larger portion of people's estate. So we really got to nail down what it means.
What's interesting, too, that I've found out through being an executor on several estates, too, is that IRAs aren't in the – like a trust. They're not in your trust. They have to be separate from the trust, right?
Yep. They are. They must be held in the contributor's name. So anyone who has an account and contributes to this – it doesn't even matter if your employer contributes some. It still ends up being you're the contributor. So it must stay by IRS code. It must stay in your personal name. Mm. And so it's one of the few assets that if you have a revocable living trust, we are not going to have that in the name of the trust. But rather, it must stay in your personal name. So we got to look at what does that mean? What does it mean during your lifetime to be able to access this? And again, IRA is going to be a general term here. I mean any account type that is tax deferred. So for example, a 457, a 401k, a 403b, a traditional IRA, a simple IRA, and what you've also stated, which is a Roth IRA. All of these accounts have a tax-deferred status. And most of these, by the way, all they're doing is they're referencing the IRS code that they are attributable to and the rules that they run under. So if you go to IRC 401, you're going to find information about a 401k. Go to specific subsection K. A 457, that's literally IRC section 457. There are rules about having tax-deferred accounts and deferred compensation as the 457. So all of these things are just referencing the IRS code, and what they're doing is these are the rules that we're going to play by. And so all of these are beholden to the IRS rules. So therefore, in order to fully unpack and unwind these, we're always beholden to the IRS. And what does it say? As you have said, they must be in the contributor's name. That is one of the first things. If I ever moved an account, an IRA account, to the name of a trust, it would immediately be taxed. That's called malpractice. That's a bad day for me. It's a bad tax day for my client. So these IRA accounts stay in your personal name, and so let's talk about them kind of in general for what are IRA accounts? What do we mean by those?
Okay. Well, first off, have there been some recent changes in IRA laws?
Yeah, definitely. IRA laws are always being maneuvered.
Right.
They're always – because we're dealing with a tax issue. So multiple years ago, there was actually a much larger change to the taxing structure. One of the things it did is it raised the required minimum distribution age to 73 instead of 70 and a half and then 72. So now most people can take their IRAs a little bit later. So that's actually a good thing for most individuals. We can let those funds mature a couple more years before you are required
to take some of it.
Mm-hmm. So an RMD is a required minimum distribution. And in a high-level educational manner, what happens is when you hit a certain age and you're required to take a distribution, on December 31st of the previous year, we look at the value, and the IRS, based upon how old you are, says use this mathematical formula, and that tells us what you are required to take. So in other words, it is a requirement. Mm. You are required to pull at least that much money out of a tax-deferred account and pull it into your checking account, transfer it to your investment account. The IRS doesn't care what you do with the money. They prefer that you spend it to help the economy. But sure. So now you're required to take money out. Why? Because it's never been taxed. And the IRS now wants you to start having money taxable. It wants you to pull it out. Now, many individuals by this time are also retired. So their income, if they're not receiving money from an employer, their annual income has now plummeted. So unless you have a pension or some other fund, income is low, and Social Security typically is a lower sum of money as well.
And who knows how long it'll be there.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Although I think pretty much nobody's ever going to get elected if they take away Social Security. So it's an election issue. It's really not a balanced budget issue. So they'll never balance the budget ever again in our lifetime, whatever. So yes, it'll be there. Will it change, and may it be more difficult? Will they raise the age limits like they have on IRAs before you can qualify? All those things will become part of the game that is played. Now, one of the things that as we look at IRAs and required minimum distributions, it's because people are living longer than what they used to. So now they need money for a longer period of time. So in one way, the government is looking at this balance of we need tax money, but yet if we ask for it too soon, individuals are going to work through their IRAs. And now when they're in their mid-80s or closer to 90, if we required them to take money too soon, and now they're living longer, there is a risk that the government is going to need to step in and actually support that individual.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's this balance of how long will people live, how much have people saved. Unfortunately, I think the average is just a little over $100,000 of retirement money. So
really, that's the average that people have saved at that point in their life?
Yeah, it's pretty small.
Even in IRAs.
Yeah. So the government doesn't want to take care of us. They want us to be self-sufficient. So therefore, we start playing with some of these rules. We start playing with Social Security. How do we help people help themselves so that we don't have to? So there's always been this change in this this balance of we want you to save for yourself, but we don't want you to start taking it too soon so that you can be self-sufficient. And we want people to be self-sufficient. And so there's kind of the brief background. When we return after break, we'll start talking about some of the other changes and how they have influenced specifically beneficiaries versus the current account holder and using it for their lifetime.
Okay, discussing IRAs, how they work with estate planning this week with Paul Grant. People are intrigued by your approach. They want to find out more. How do they do that, Paul?
Head over to our website, legacyandfaith.com. There's past podcasts, upcoming educational opportunities, ways to communicate with us, all found at legacyandfaith.com.
Back with more of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant in just a moment.
Can I avoid probate? Will I lose everything if my health becomes compromised? How do I preserve what I have for me and my family? Will the government take it all? This is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. These are some of the most common questions we get on a daily basis, and there are solutions for all of these issues. It is time for you to protect your family and what God has placed under your stewardship, and we can help. Go to legacyandfaith.com to find out more about our services and upcoming educational opportunities. That's legacyandfaith.com.
Your photos, slides, scrapbooks, and home movies are invaluable and irreplaceable. Barry Kenny here with the Bear Services. Call us to save them as digital files to be stored electronically and shared liberally. We will even come to you so they stay in your possession. Go to thebearservices.com for more information. That's thebearservices.com.
We now return to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant, and continue today's practical discussion to apply biblical principles for kingdom purposes.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, discussing how IRAs fit in with estate planning and some changes recently to IRA law, as they say, and that's what Paul is going to continue to fill us in on.
Yeah, you asked before break, what are some of the changes in laws? And I talked about some things that mildly influence the account holder. But what the big changes were is what happens when the account holder dies. And so I want to discuss some of the balance between what the old rule used to be, what the new rule is, and how it changes, because this is where we get these to connect in estate planning. So first of all, I'm going to talk about what the law used to be and what maybe some people still think the law is. So the old law was that if I were to die holding an IRA and now I have beneficiaries. So let's assume all of this is working properly. You've named beneficiaries and we know who they are. So
beneficiaries in your trust and will or beneficiaries on the IRA document?
The answer to that is yes.
Okay.
So it could be yes. It depends on what type of an instrument you use for your estate planning. But let's make it simple for right now. And let's talk about you've named on the account a beneficiary. It's not a trust and it's not to your estate. So let's make it probably the most common way people leave their IRA accounts, their retirement funds, is to name a beneficiary with the financial institution so that when they pass away, someone has to give a death certificate and show that they are a beneficiary, and then they can take over the asset. Now, when they take over the asset, the old law used to be that we would look at the beneficiary and we'd say, how old are you? And so let's say that the average beneficiary is 55 years old. And so let's say that they're 55 and now they've taken over this IRA. Well, they could have gone, so this is the old law, they could have gone to an IRS table. It's called a single life calculation, a single life table, and they would look at how old they are. And this table would tell them how much they need to take each year to satisfy now a beneficiary's required minimum distribution. So it was very similar to what the account holder was under, which is required minimum distributions. But a beneficiary would be able to take this over the course of their entire lifetime. Mm. That is now changed. That is now changed to being a 10-year rule. Okay? So because the government wants their money faster, they want money to be taxed, they have now put into place a 10-year rule. So when I die and I have an IRA, again, for simplicity, let's say I name my daughters as the beneficiaries, then we look at them, and unless they have an exception, they are going to need to take that IRA sum out of the IRA and have it taxed over the next 10 years. This speeds up the taxing system, right? Mm. This speeds up that money has to be withdrawn faster out of an IRA. Again, it retains its characteristic as not being taxed yet. So Now, when the beneficiary takes it, because it's never been taxed, the beneficiary has to pay the tax, and they have to do it more quickly than what they used to. Mm. So it used to be a lifetime stretch. Now it is a 10-year rule. So for example, many beneficiaries may look at a 10-year rule and go, well, fine, I'll just take 1/10, 1/9, 1/8, 1/7, all the way down until the last remaining portion in the last year and the 10th year. I'm just going to take the remaining portion. That's a good system. That's an equal distribution throughout the 10 years. And we mathematically, we end up getting that to work even with some of the appreciation. And beneficiaries are pulling very consistent sums. Right now, for most beneficiaries, that's probably the most consistent taxing way. But what if you have a beneficiary, because remember, I used an example of their 55. Most people would make the largest sum of money in their lifetime between the age of 50 and 65. Mm. That's because they finally got rid of the kids out of the house.
Right.
They can actually hold more money. Their experience is at a premium, so they're going to get raises and they're more valuable to companies. So typically, people are going to earn more money during their 50s and early 60s than any other time of their life. So what if I am making the most money I've ever made in my life at the age of 55, and now I have a parent pass away, assume there's no spouse, and it's coming to a child who's making more money than ever before. And now they are under this new law that says, by the way, you've got to take your IRAs faster than what you were supposed to in the past. So now the beneficiary is making good money. They're already in a higher tax bracket. Now we're going to add more tax money because they have to take some of their inherited, and it adds to their taxable income, right? Because it's regular income. And now they're at a higher tax bracket. If you want to talk from the governmental perspective, that was pretty ingenious, because now we're having more money taxed and at a higher tax rate for the average inheritor. All of a sudden, the IRA being passed is taxed much higher and at much higher rates than what the contributor was, the original account holder was at the end of their life. So there are some strategies that if we look at the family holistically instead of just individually, remember, we've been trained by the financial institutions, by your financial advisor to say, push off taxes, push off taxes, push off taxes. And this is a fight of changing financial advisors and CPAs' thought process of, well, what happens when the 55-year-old who's making $150,000, $200,000 or more a year is all of a sudden going to have to pull this money out? Now what? And so there can be a strategy when we look at the family holistically to say, is it better for the family as a whole in looking at the taxes for the contributor in their late 70s and 80s, provided that money is not going to run out, okay, provided it is going to be okay for them financially to actually pay more taxes because they're at a lower tax bracket than their beneficiaries. So now we take money that is at a lower tax bracket, exchange it for assets that are going to get a step up in basis and are going to be given to a beneficiary at a far better taxing system or a better tax rate when we look holistically at the family instead of just looking at ourselves. Now, no one likes to pay taxes. I mean, if you like to pay taxes, be sure just to email me because then I can send you my tax bill. But no one likes to pay it. But there are strategies when we look at the family holistically that may lend to actually having the account holder take more out of their IRA.
In their life.
In their lifetime, during their lifetime, putting that into an investment account. Again, that's going to get a step up in basis so that when you pass away, there's no tax handed to the beneficiaries. But again, provided it's not going to hurt the client. Everything has to be about making sure the client has sufficient funds and that it's not going to be a burden financially later down the road. That would be the worst case scenario. So that would be a bad strategy if we put somebody into a worse financial position just to save a little bit of taxes. Mm. That's a bad plan. Mm. So, but if it's going to be sustainable, then we may want to look at the family holistically as it comes to IRAs before anyone even passes away. So when we talk about looking at IRAs and how they function in estate planning, this can be one thing that we may want to sit down and talk about. Mm. Pull in financial advisors, pull in CPAs, make sure we're all making the decision together and make sure that it's going to be best for the estate and for the client simultaneously. There's more to be said than just simply deferring IRAs forever and ever.
Okay, how do IRAs work with your estate planning? That's the discussion this week. We will continue this discussion next time. People are intrigued by your thought process on this. How do they find out more about your services, Paul?
Well, our website has a lot of information, past podcasts, educational opportunities, and ways to communicate with us. And you can go to legacyandfaith.com to find all of that and more.
It's the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant.
Thank you for joining us for the Legacy and Faith Show. You can find more information about the show and Paul Grant at legacyandfaith.com. Join us next week at the same time as we learn to build God's kingdom and continue our journey on how to protect wealth and family values for generations. All discussions on the Legacy and Faith Show are intended to be about general legal issues. If a situation applies to you, then we encourage you to seek specific legal advice. Please do not rely upon any discussions from this program in place of having a personal relationship with your attorney. Any listener question that may have been answered also does not constitute legal advice and does not establish a client-attorney relationship.